trying to interpret the whole of the Old Testament. And so we're going to repeat some things that we've said before, but they're worth repeating. They're worth repeating. And so we're going to work after a couple of minutes through the handouts that you got, although you will see some familiar things in that. But that is because we want to kind of tie a ribbon around the book as we come to this last session. But I omitted to say something really important last week. And if you just turn for a moment to 2 Chronicles 20, which is where we ended last week, which is that great passage of Jehoshaphat going into battle. And he, you remember, sets the singers in front of the army. And the Lord says that you can stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. He says you will not have to fight this battle. I'm going to fight it for you. And that is where we finished last week. But there was just one thing that I forgot to say. And so I will just say that, and then we will get into our review. So if you turn to 2 Chronicles 20, and we'll read that. And then we will, that is not a bad place to stop. We haven't quite got to the end of 2 Chronicles. That doesn't really matter because you've got the kind of the meat of where the book is. And what we read last week is, you remember in verse 17, the prophet says, 2 Chronicles 20, you need not fight in this battle. Station yourselves, stand and see the salvation of the Lord on your behalf, O Judah and Jerusalem. Do not fear or be dismayed. We heard something about that this morning. Tomorrow, go out and face them, for the Lord is with you. All they had to do, they didn't have to strike a single blow, but they did have to face their enemies. And then in verse 21 and 22, one of the most famous paragraphs in the Bible. And when he had consulted with the people, verse 21, he appointed those who sang to the Lord and who praised the splendor of his holiness as they went out before the army. So you've got to visualize this. It's quite extraordinary. This is not Disney World. This is not Star Wars. This is real history. So here come the singers before the army, and they quote, Psalm 136, verse 1. I mentioned this last time. Okay, this is what they quote. If you can just see that I'm focused, Jenny. Here, if you can help me. Okay, this is what they quote. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His loving kindness endures forever. Psalm 136, verse 1. That is what they sing. And when they began to sing and praise, when they began singing and praising, the Lord set ambushes, his angels, against the sons of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, Mount Seir, who had come out so that they were annihilated. Verse 28, then they came to Jerusalem, and as I said, this begins and ends in the temple, this story. They come to Jerusalem with harps, lyres, trumpets to the house of the Lord. And, you see, this was their national security. And the dread of God was on all the kingdoms of the lands when they heard that the Lord had fought against the enemies of Israel. And what I said last week, we finished with this, is that this is quoted three times in Chronicles, okay? It's first quoted, okay, in 2 Chronicles 5:13, and do you remember from last week what incident that was? This is not a test, but just see if you do. Okay, Jenny is kind of whispering in my ear here. So this was when they brought the ark into the temple. And when they brought the ark, they built the temple, they brought the ark in, and they quoted this. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for his loving kindness endures forever. And when they quoted this, God came down and his glory fell and everybody is on their face. Now, Solomon then, they move on, they dedicate the temple, they have his great prayer of dedication and God's promises, and then, as they're dedicating the temple, they sing again, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His loving kindness endures forever," and the fire of God falls, the glory of God falls, and everybody is on their face again. So they had a lot of carpet time, you know, at this point. They're just on their faces again and again. Now, if you were them, and if you were Jehoshaphat, and if when this psalm is quoted, God comes down, hey, if you were in that army, okay, if you were in that choir being pushed out ahead of the army, what would you sing? Okay, I know what I would sing, this one, because when they sing this again, God comes down and sends his angels, and it's not glory, but it is the defeat of their enemies. So this is a great verse. And as I said, this is the psalm that repeats this phrase in every verse of the psalm. Now, what I didn't say last week, which I should have said, is this is the question we ask every chapter in Chronicles: who was it written for? Okay? So tell me, who was Chronicles written for? You know this. Okay, the disenfranchised. Give me some more. The exiles, that's right. They had come back. You see, they had never seen this, okay? This was just for them, as it is for you this morning. They had never seen it. They weren't alive when it happened. It was something God had done in the past, just like for us, okay? They'd never lived through those days. And in fact, it's worse than that. Everything that they had seen, their cities, everything that Joshua had done, Moses had done, Jehoshaphat had done, David had done, so it's all been, it's like a scorched earth policy. It has gone. And this little remnant comes back, okay? And this, you see, this is not written in Kings. They had kings. This was written for them, okay? Because they had to face a lot of things. They were surrounded by hostile enemies. It seemed that they did not have a chance. No nation that was dispersed like Israel ever returned. You'll not find it anywhere in world history. Once they're scattered to that extent, they never ever return. And so these folks are coming, but it seems impossible. So what does the chronicler write? He writes this little story. He says, go out and face them. And then you say, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His loving kindness endures forever. And what's going to happen? God's going to come down and scatter our enemies. And we need that word today, don't we? We need that word on every front. We need that word today. So that's not a bad place to kind of stop in Chronicles, if we have to stop. But let me just do here a little review. And bear with me if you've been faithfully in the class each week. But there's something I've never heard. I've never been taught Chronicles, ever. Has anybody ever had a class on Chronicles? Anybody in the room ever had a class on Chronicles? It's kind of one of those neglected books of the Bible. And so I'm going to have a little review. It's worth reviewing, okay? This is worth reviewing. We'll get to your sheet in a minute. One, it is significant. This is the last book of the Old Testament in the Hebrew Bible. It is the last. That's significant, okay? And it is an attempt to interpret, okay, the meaning and message of the whole Old Testament. That's what he's doing for this little group of people who hadn't lived in those days. And we didn't live in those days. You see, this was as new to them as it is for us. And that's why it's important. Now, it's written, and that's why it's so important. It's written to a people who have lost everything and are facing overwhelming internal and external challenges. Now, are we not facing overwhelming internal and external challenge it. That's why, you see, this story, Jehoshaphat, doesn't come in Kings, doesn't come in Samuel, it comes in Chronicles, because he says, you need to hear this. And that's what's happening here. Now, the method he employs, you remember, is very interesting, and I'll remind you of it again. He uses a genealogy and a narrative. And his genealogy, which we looked at, and Diane counted the names, and as I remember, Diane, in this genealogy, there are 1,166, I think. And we looked at them. I mean, if you were here, that I thought I would have everybody asleep as we worked our way through the genealogies, but you stuck with it. We got through them. The interesting thing is he goes right back to Adam. If you're giving a history of Israel, you don't go back to Adam. You go back to
Abraham.
That's right. But he's saying, no. You see, this is going right back to the roots of creation, and he's going as far as he can do, right to the time when the chronicler is alive, when these people have come back. Now, we don't know how long that period of time is. We don't know when Adam lived. Estimates can be made. And so if this is the timeline, and Adam is sitting at the door there, okay, and the chronicler is at the divide there, that is the great kind of timeline. And he wants you to understand, you see, history is going somewhere. That's what Chronicles is saying. And as you've heard me say before, every religion is circular. The great wheel of birth, okay, maturation or maturity, reproduction, and death. That is world religion, with the exception of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Islam simply borrows from the Bible. That's what it does. Every other religion is circular, but God says, no, history has a meaning. It means something. It's intentional. God is taking us somewhere. We are a pilgrim people. We're not going around in circles. But what does it mean? What does it mean? And so having given us that great genealogy, world history and a genealogy, he takes a little piece. Now, we don't know how long relative to this little piece is, you know, whether it's this, okay, wall to wall here, how long is this piece? We don't know whether it's this long or this long, we have no idea, but it's not very big. But what he says is, understand this from the reign of David, okay, and Solomon to the end of the Davidic kings. If you understand this, what God was after, you understand this. And obviously, because he's seeking to interpret the meaning of the whole of the Old Testament. So he employs the method of a genealogy and a narrative. And then his great interpretive key for the whole, not just the whole Old Testament, the whole of human history, is the model of the temple. And so what he does, and I, as I say, you've seen these before, this is Chronicles. And the interesting thing is he spends 29 chapters on two kings. And really, these two kings are only doing one thing. One is preparing to build the temple, and his name is David. And the other one is building it, and his name is Solomon. Everything else is a kind of footnote. And so the preparation is the genealogy. It's laying his foundation. Okay, then the consummation of Chronicles. This is why we spent a lot of time here, because this is his grid for interpreting what God is seeking to do in human history. That's why when the Bible ends, we have a model of a temple. But this temple now has leavened a whole city, and this city has leavened the whole earth. That's where the Bible ends. So he's laying in this model, and that's why we spent most of our time up here. Then there's an application, because if we get it right, we'll have kingdom life. If we get it wrong, we'll lose kingdom life. And that's why we've been looking at some of these rather disappointing kings. Then the other thing, before we look at our sheet, that I've said many times, but this makes total sense if this is the book that is now summing up the Old Testament that the three institutions created by God, which are, help me, family, church, and state, okay, three institutions created by God are all represented in this temple model. And as I've said before, it's a great shame that we ever use the word temple, because it's simply the Hebrew word bayit, which is the word for house. And God's intention is that the whole cosmos become his house. That's what's happening in the book of Revelation. Okay? The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ. You see, then it says now, the tabernacle, this is the end of the Bible, the end of human history, that the tabernacle, the house of God, the dwelling place of God, is now with men. That's where human history, that's where God is going. And you see, we began that God wanted to share his great love life, the great camaraderie, the great family of the Trinity. He wanted to share that great camaraderie of love and self-giving and warmth and acceptance and holiness and blessing. He wanted to share that with the human race. It's totally astonishing. And God has not deviated from that purpose. And that loving family, that loving household that we call the Trinity, you see, that was God's eternal house. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you see, that's where he wants to bring us in to the Father's house. And so when Jesus is going away, he says, he's going out to die, and he says, in my Father's house, there are many. That's right, there are many abiding places. That's literally the word. Abiding places, places to tabernacle. End of the Bible. Now, the tabernacle of God is with man. Okay, God has pitched his tent right where he intended it to be. Or rather, now the Trinity has encircled the cosmos. And we're drawn into that family of love. That's God's intention, and he has never deviated from it for one moment. That is why we're alive, to be adopted into that great family of God's love. And as I've said before, and I don't mind saying things again. You might mind me saying them, okay? But I didn't say it when Meryl and Meg was, so I'm going to embarrass you both, because you're going to riding across America, so you can, when you're climbing, you know, day 11, 14,000 feet, you can say, I'm so glad I'm here, because Ray would embarrass me if I was in his class, okay? So when Michael and Laura, you see, when they got married, okay, there was that little community of love. And as I've said before, you see, that you were married for how long before you had Meryl?
6 years,
you see. So when Meryl was born and when Meg was born, they didn't kind of start, you see, they were born into a community of love. They didn't kind of start from zero. They came into that love that was flowing between Michael and Laura. That's what they were born into, you see. And that's God's intention. He wants us to be born into the love that the Father has for the Son and the Son has for the Father. That is your destiny. And one of the great tragedies is that the word adoption has been almost deleted. Calvin was a great man to use the word adoption in the Reformation. But since then, it's been so neglected, the word adoption. But that's what God is after. And as I said, it's a great shame that we don't simply use the word house, because that family is where human history started. That family is going to encompass the whole earth, okay? And that is God's household. And the temple is simply modeling that. And so the various circles that were created by God are represented in God's house, And you've seen this before. Okay, so here's the temple, but under this umbrella of the temple, okay, we have the realm, of priesthood and atonement, one stream. We have the realm of kingship and governance, that's another stream, so that all the families of the earth might be blessed. And so we have We have kingship, we have priesthood, and we have family, or we have family, we have church, and we have state under this great kind of umbrella model. And of course, the temple must represent all these realms if it's to be not simply a religious institution, but it's to represent a paradigm of the kingdom of God. If it's a representation of the paradigm of the kingdom of God, then it must embrace the three realms that are created by God if he's going to reign. Otherwise, if you see, the temple is the church. If it's only the church, God then just rules over the church. I'm so glad he doesn't stop ruling, aren't you? I'm so glad he's not just limited to the church. Now, thank God that we truly are the kingdom. We truly are the kingdom, okay? But the church is not the boundary of the kingdom, because God will not rest content, as I've said. Revelation, we will find the reign of God is over families, it's over church, it's over the kingdoms of this world. That's where he's going. That's what his kingdom is. And so our concerns are not simply for the church. My concern is not simply for my spiritual life. It is for education. It's for economics. It's for the poor. It's for governance. It's for engineering. It's for architecture. Okay, it's every realm, you see. God wants to put his foot down and leave his imprint and leave something of his love and his goodness, his kindness and his justice. That is his kingdom. And all that is represented in this paradigm of the temple. But it's so hard for us to shift away from simple religion and see that God's kingdom is now overarching every dimension of what it means to be human. Now, you've heard me say that 18 times before, but I said it again. So what we're going to do now, we're going to, if you'd like to draw out that little sheet that you've got here that says basic principles of governance drawn from Chronicles. So what we're going to do is do a very quick review. Any questions? We're going to do a very quick review. And then if we have time, we're going to finish that little thing on the law that we started a couple of weeks ago. But we'll see if we have time. Any questions? Yes, Ed?
The bane of David is an idiom, and it's translated House of David, Tent of David, and another. And the point is, David's literal children didn't do it.
Right.
His family in the natural was a catastrophe, in my opinion, as was Solomon's. But David's family, house or tent, was actually war. The giant, the general was willing to be anointed with the Holy Spirit and kill giants. Like
yes.
David.
Yes.
And therefore, even the only one I could see that was part of his family was Jonathan, who was Saul's son, right?
Yes.
So the house of David was evidently the beginning of civil government in the whole covenant trajectory.
Yes. Yes.
Was Solomon's, but they only taught it.
That's right. That's right. They taught it. They didn't demonstrate it, and that is the sad thing. And that is a lesson, that's a salutary lesson for us. We don't want to just teach it. We want to demonstrate it. We want to live it. And it's a great shame that the paradigm that was set up by Solomon himself is not faithful to that paradigm. Anyway, let's do a quick review here. And we're taking principles from Chronicles. And the first one is very, very obvious. We're seeing in Chronicles now that there is, now we need to be very careful on what we do with this word, okay, but there is a separation of Levi and Judah, of kingship and priesthood. There is a separation, okay, not of the gospel and politics, okay, we'll say more about that in a moment, but why have I put Isaiah there from Chronicles? We didn't get to Isaiah. Why have I put him there? Do you remember? Okay, Isaiah got leprosy. Do you remember why he got leprosy? Okay, because Isaiah, you see, after he had established himself, he was a very great king, he had great wealth, but you remember he crossed the boundary and he invaded the sphere of the temple and he went in to offer incense on the golden altar in the holy place. And God struck him with leprosy because he says that there is to be, okay, not a separation of the gospel and politics, but something, now we need to define what this means, a separation of church and state, in the sense that the separation, as the morphology that was worked out here, was to protect the church from the control of the state, not to separate the state from the influence of the church. And so if we put up our famous circles, which you are entirely bored of seeing now, but this is so that if you never get to Chronicles again, you see, you will remember that I embarrassed Merrill and Meg, and that we had our famous circles up again. And when we talk about, okay, so here's the family, here's the church, and here's the state. Okay, when we talk about a separation, we're not speaking about an isolation. There is an overlapping and there is a leavening of the two circles. But the separation of church and state was to protect, okay, the church from what had been happening in Europe, from being controlled by the state, not to insulate the state from the leavening that the gospel and the good news and the people of God would bring into. But how it's used now, as I put on your sheet, now it's used to limit, mute, and exclude religious influence on public life. It was never designed to do that, and you never find that. Although there is this separation, they're complementary spheres. They're complementary spheres. Okay, then we've said, we appropriately position the state alongside the family and the church. And we've said many, many times in this class that with our circles, and it was actually Bob that was, you helped me a lot on this one, Bob, the boundaries are everything. Where we draw these boundaries, where you draw those boundaries will determine your view of civic governance. In Israel, for most of its history, this circle was very small, very small. Compared to today, the circle was microscopic. Under Solomon, you see, and God warned them, the circle grew bigger, and what happened when the circle grew bigger? Okay, there was corruption, there was an abuse of power, etc., etc. In the 20th century, this is what happened to the circle. So you get Mussolini saying nothing over the state, nothing alongside the state, nothing outside the state. The state is everything. And it tends to become a leviathan and swallow up everything. And so we have to be very, very careful that we draw boundaries, not to mean that there is not overlapping here. We're not leavening, of course. But you see, there are boundaries. I am a pastor, but there are certain boundaries I cannot cross when it comes to your family. You see, there are certain things I do not have any right to do in the boundaries that God has set around your family. I can speak into it, and we should speak into it. Do you see the point? But there's a line I cannot cross. And so it is of all those circles. And you see, what you put in the circles, for instance, where you put the economy, where you put education, where you put welfare, whether you put it in here, or and we've said that this is technically what we call the private sector. In other words, it's not controlled by the state. It's more a voluntary association. Determines everything. And think that out. Carry that away. That is very important. And you'll see that reflected in Chronicles. And now I've lost my other piece, which is not uncommon for me. Okay, and then I said, thirdly, we identify the areas where they're responsible to each other. The church has a responsibility. Okay, and you see it there. And this is why the recent Catholic Church scandals, you see, why that is so disheartening is that the area for which the church was seen to be responsible okay, to uphold integrity, to uphold morality, to uphold purity, it grossly and tragically failed. You see, we didn't fulfill our responsibilities. But there are areas we are responsible, just as we hold the state responsible for certain areas as well. And we need to be very sure that if we are speaking prophetically into the states, that our own household is in order. You see, otherwise we have no leverage. We have no leverage on which to stand. And one of the difficulties, Jenny was and I were talking, one of the difficulties we have now with same-sex marriage is we have so given way to the cult of hedonism, personal happiness outranks everything. You see, my personal autonomy, my personal happiness, it outranks everything. That has never, ever been so in the history of the world. Okay, you read history even today, many more ancient societies, they would never see themselves as radical individuals. Never. They're embedded in families. Families are embedded in neighborhoods. Neighborhoods are embedded in cities, and so we go on. But you see, if we, and this is what's happened with postmodernism, it's radical autonomy. It's not just autonomy, it's radical autonomy. And if there's radical autonomy, happiness then becomes our great mantra. And so if we've given way to that, how can you speak against a smiling, happy couple coming down the steps of the courthouse in Massachusetts? You see, because we've given way to autonomy. We've given way. Personal happiness outranks everything else. No other society would have said that in history. The good of the society, the good of the generations coming behind us, okay, the good of the kind of moral ecosystem is something that I have to sacrifice my personal happiness for. And that's why we simply, even Plato said, in the Republic, there would be no divorce. He wasn't even a Christian. Didn't come from the community of Israel. But he saw that society could not work if divorce was tolerated. Well, divorce now. And please, if you've been divorced, this is no condemnation. Of course, I could list all the commandments and we could all show guilty. And so when I say these things, please, it's not a word against you. It's simply a reflection on where we are in the Western world. And so how I got there, I'm not sure. But that's common as well. That's right, the church upholding its error. Page 2, and we're going to pause for a few questions. Okay, and again, I kind of feel apologetic that I'm repeating myself, but these things are worth pondering. And so, sorry for doing it, but they are very important. We also recognize, okay, these three areas, their dependence on each other. And this is the triangle I've been using, the triangle of freedom, virtue, and what we will call religion. That's not a popular word today, but I don't want to call it faith, because faith is anything. I should really put the Christian religion there. But this has been what we've been working on, and you remember, and this is, you could track this almost chapter by chapter through Chronicles, and again, you can go back to the founders here who, for instance, Jefferson and Adams were not evangelicals, but they certainly were leaning on the Judeo-Christian tradition when they were working out a morphology of governance. They really were leaning into that. And they said, if we want freedom, okay, and everybody wants freedom, don't they? Everybody wants freedom, okay? But freedom, you see, doesn't stand alone. You can't have a stool with one leg, okay? Okay, everybody wants freedom. And they said, now, if you're going to have freedom, you've got to have virtue or morality. Because where virtue, morality, is lost, freedom collapses. Of course it does. That's why you had a Saddam Hussein. Because, you see, virtue had collapsed, and so inevitably totalitarianism takes over. But they, you see, now the EU wants the European Union that took in 10 new nations 2 weeks ago, they want a virtue, freedom, axis. That's what they want. And the founders said, that's a two-legged stool. It will not stand. But that's exactly what the European Union is doing right now. And as I said, in the Constitution, they will not mention God. They will not mention Christianity, despite that there wouldn't be a Europe without Christianity. It's ridiculous. Okay, I'm not saying that they shouldn't give some mention of other influences on Europe, but this is being done by people who when you filter out books and censor, they hate censorship, and they're censoring out the very foundations of their society. It is bizarre. They want a society that's built on the axis of freedom and virtue. And the founders said that won't work, because if we're going to have virtue, it's got to be anchored. It can only be anchored in something higher, you see. It's not a gas. It's not a vapor. People are not naturally virtuous. They will only be virtuous if there's some transcendentals, if there's a God out there, okay, who's given law and to whom we've had accountable. And then the reason they'd come is because if we want religion, we have to have freedom. And that's why the Mayflower sailed, and so on and so forth. And all these were dependent and interacting on one another. Now, this is the circle of the family. Okay, this is the circle of the states. Okay, sorry, this is the circle of the state. And this is the circle of the church. Now, you say, this is the circle. Now, you see, we now, okay, as the church, we inform this circle, okay, but morals, ethics, behavior, okay, respect, etc., etc., the circle for that is the family. It really is. Deuteronomy 6, that's what you're to do. Now, that circle is informed by Scripture, which is coming out of the church, okay, but that is absolutely indispensable, you see. And so we have if you're a parent, or you will be a parent, you see, this is your end of the triangle, okay? Now here, okay, where to seed these, and of course these are overlapping, where to seed them with the truth of Revelation. And therefore, we will have a free society. But you see, if we do this, excuse me, okay, which is what they want to do in the European Union. When in Britain, you see, we began to turn away from the gospel, immediately virtue, morality, they used to be said an Englishman's word was his bond. They were insulted if you said we need to write up a contract. No, my word is my bond. Now, when we lost this, excuse me, we lost this, you see. Now, we're just about hanging on to this, but there won't be any longevity. I mean, yes, you can look at 20, 30, 50 years, but if we're looking for a society that will stand the test of time, there must, freedom is going to work, it's got to have virtue. If there's going to be virtue, there's got to be revelation from God. And if religion is going to work, there needs to be freedom. And so, you've heard me say that 18 and a half times as well before. So, but this is a review, so I get this. And this does me good, you see, to say these things again, because I need to remember them. Okay, but I always feel embarrassed saying them again. All three have distinct mechanisms of enforcement, okay? The family has the rod, the church has the keys. We only have the authority to put people out of the community of Christ if they won't walk according to the gospel. And the government bears the sword. And we get into trouble when, as with the Crusades, we try and use the sword, and as in some sections of the church, they've tried to use the rod. Distinct mechanisms of enforcement. And then we recognize, and this is really important, that the glue of society is law. Now, many people will say, no, I want the glue of society to be love. Sounds very nice, doesn't it? You know. But as, again, you've heard me say, love is law radicalized. There's no dichotomy between law and love. Okay? If you marry and have children, as much as you love them, will there or will there not be a few little regulations in the household? Now, so I've talked to them. Now I'm going to talk to you, okay? So you just keep out of the way here. Will or will there not be a few little ground rules on how you operate in this household? Like coming in at 4 a.m. might not be acceptable, etc., etc. Okay, now you say, well, then this wonderful community of love that I've been talking about them being born into, it doesn't operate. Now there's law. Of course, law, love is simply law radicalized. There's no dichotomy between the two. And that's why Jesus says, now, the whole law is summed up in what? Love your neighbor as yourself. And of course, the other configuration, love God and love your neighbor. And you've got the whole law. Jesus doesn't dismiss it. He radicalizes it. And that's what the law is. And as we've said before, the Catholic social doctrine, they want to use what we call the first table of the law, because everybody agrees with that. And in one way, that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. But again, you see, that what we find in Chronicles, you see, in Israel will never keep the second table when they abandon the first. And so that's why the prophets, again and again and again, are dealing with things like idolatry. They hit that. Or Israel is turning away from the Lord. They hit that because when Israel doesn't keep the first table, neither do they keep the second table. And that's why the end of Judges, if you haven't read the end of Judges recently, it is the most disgusting events you'll ever read. What's been happening in the prison in Baghdad you can't hold a candle to the end of Judges. It's appalling. It's absolutely appalling. Gang rape, you remember, of the Benjaminite and his concubine, etc. Sorry, the Levite who was in the land of Benjamin, and they gang rape his concubine, etc., etc., and then she's cutting pieces, etc., etc. It's horrible. It's horrible. Why, you see? Because, you see, when we lose the first table, okay, we won't keep the second table. And so this, as good as it is, you see, has got to be anchored. It's got to be anchored. And as you've heard me say before, we won't keep the law unless we will be called to account. And we're just like that. This is my Pacific story. You all know my Pacific story because it's reinforced every Sunday when I'm driving to church and that little bit of Pacific. Do you drive at 35 on that bit of Pacific? Not usually, okay. Neither do I, because it's empty and it's 4 lanes and feels like you could get out at walk and walk at 35. You live there. You know that bit of Pacific, don't you? This is crazy. So I cruise up to 40, but when I'm cruising at 40, I'm looking in my mirror. Why am I looking in my mirror? Because I might hit somebody from behind? No, I'm not looking in my mirror because I might hit somebody from behind. I'm looking for that little red light, you see, because enforcement, we need enforcement. Children, there's no sense as a parent saying, be good. No, there's going to be some grounding or something else, you see. We need that. We need that. Humanity needs that. And so that is where both tables of the law are hugely important and cannot really be separated. Can't really be separated. One other thing, then I'll pause for a few questions. Okay, what's the next point on your sheet? Would you read it to me? What is the next point? Okay, the spirit of Jezebel. Okay, now this is an important theme in Chronicles, really very important in Chronicles. And you remember with the good King Jehoshaphat, and I'm only going to use this as a launching pad here for this point. Thank you. Okay, in the north, you remember, we have Ahab, who marries Jezebel, and she is not an Israelite, and she is committed to the worship of Baal. Okay? Now, that's bad enough, but in the south, good King Jehoshaphat and his unnamed wife, okay, they arrange for their son, Jehoram, to marry the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, Athaliah. Now, we have here a kind of seismic movement in Israel. Because as I said before, Israel always broke the law, okay? And God's law has always been broken. But what is Jezebel going to try and do? Help me if you've been here before. She's going to replace it. She's going to rewrite it. She's not afraid of breaking it. She wants to replace it. Now that's where we are today in the West. You see, now we're looking at this great Judeo-Christian heritage on which Western civilization has been built. We've never been faithful to that tradition. We've often broken it, but now you see there's a change come. We want to replace it. We want to replace it. And that's why, as I've said before, if you go to Kings, you have 11 chapters on Solomon and the temple, yet you have 12 chapters on Elijah and Elisha. And the great kind of pinnacle of the prophets, Elisha, is raised up for this moment. For this moment. To stand in the gap, and what begins in the south is now imported, what begins in the north is imported through the marriage of Athaliah, Jezebel's daughter, okay, and then when Athaliah and Jehoram have their son, okay, Athaliah is in the wings. When he dies, she murders all of her grandchildren, all six except one. Can you imagine that? Murdering all your six grandchildren. It is unbelievable. And 9 years after Jehoshaphat dies, she is on the throne. And of course, what she's doing is importing into the south everything that her mother had been importing into the north. And law was being replaced. And what I've put on your sheet, and again, I'm not going to go into it, please do not be beguiled. There is no neutral ground. It does not exist. And when people talk about, you know, we just want a secular society, that is as dogmatic as anything you will ever say about the scriptures. If somebody says, well, we just want this to be secular, you must have presuppositions, you see. And when people pretend that naturalism, okay, or, value-free tolerance is somehow neutral, it is not neutral. It is a position. And I remember... naturalism is an affirmation that nothing exists outside of the natural world. Okay, so like Carl Sagan, many of you have read or seen Carl Sagan's programs. Carl Sagan says, the universe is all there ever was, all there is, and all there ever will be. That is naturalism. But Andrew says, there is nothing in the natural world to push you to that conclusion. There's nothing in the natural world that pushes you to the conclusion that there's nothing outside of the natural world. Absolutely nothing. And so naturalism is a faith position, that the boundary stops there. That is a faith commitment. Secularism is a faith commitment. Value-free tolerance contains as many presuppositions as does theism. And so please don't be duped. Don't be duped. France says we want a secular society so that everybody can kind of cohabit in peace. That's nonsense. Beginning with the French Revolution, it was founded. It was founded on a distinct kind of seismic change that France has never recovered from. And so please do not. And again, in Chronicles, this is why we have the stories of Ahab, Jezebel, Athaliah, Elisha, and because they're standing against this. And then just one reminder here. Of course, this brings us right up to today. And I said this before, but I'm saying it again. because you can get utterly bored and not come back next week, you see. You don't have to come back next week. And so if you're utterly bored, you say this person just says what he said before, that's fine. You don't need to come back next week. Okay. So as I've said before, anyone can marry. Anyone can marry. Bishop Gene Robinson, he married and had children, but you can't marry anybody. Is that not reasonable? And so anyone can marry, you see, but in the past, anyone could not be free during slavery. Anyone could not have full human rights during apartheid. Anyone could not vote until there was universal suffrage. But anyone can marry. Anyone can marry. There's no restriction of human rights. Anyone can marry, but you cannot marry anyone. Okay, you can't marry anyone. There have always been restrictions on who you can marry. You can't marry your mother. Okay? You can't marry your mother. You can't marry your father. You can't marry your brother. You can't marry your sister. You can't marry your grandfather. You can't marry your grandmother. You can't marry, depending on where you live, your first cousin. Okay? You can't marry somebody of a certain blood type. And you can't marry somebody of the same sex. Never, ever have been able to in human history, even when, as in the days of Socrates, homosexuality was ubiquitous, it was everywhere, but you still couldn't marry somebody of your own sex. And so you see, this is not a violation of human rights, you see, because anyone can marry. Anyone can marry, but you can't marry anyone. And so you see, the law is being changed. That's what it is. There's no violation of human rights here. Anybody can go out and get married. But you have never, ever, in any society in history, been able to marry anyone. So if you come along and said, my father has died and I love my mother so much, I want to marry her, sorry, you can't. Okay? Why can't I? Why can't I? Because you've never been able to marry your mother, okay, in human history. You can't marry a man, okay? And it's a little silly that we have to have a constitutional amendment. If you'd have gone up to Jefferson and said, Jefferson, I'm going to get married. You know, John Adams, I'm going to get married. They wouldn't have turned around and said, you're going to marry a man or a woman, okay? But they've said that, wouldn't have entered their heads, wouldn't have entered their heads. So it's silly that we have to have a constitutional amendment, but we will have to have one. Anyway, now I'm just ranting, so you didn't come here for that. Questions? Not necessarily on that, but on this review. Yes, chat.
By which you've pointed out that we, and I'm thinking of the church, have failed so miserably to maintain a standard that we don't have a credibility, or I think you to use the term leverage, in order to fight the battle. Does that necessarily mean the battle cannot be won?
No, it doesn't, because God is great, and God is kind, and God is good. The question was, because we've given away our leverage by giving way to radical autonomy, etc., etc., does it mean the battle can't be won? No, it doesn't, because the grace of God is there to overcome and override our unfaithfulness, as he was in Israel. Jesus was born, okay? The cross did happen. The resurrection did take place, despite all their unfaithfulness, and that is our great hope. But there doesn't excuse, you see, there was great loss by Solomon's unfaithfulness. Great loss. And there will be by ours. Doesn't mean to say that God's purposes, you see, God's purposes, he will never abandon his purposes, okay? To make the habitation of God will be with man, and humanity will be brought within the circle of the Trinity. God won't. It's just, will we have the privilege of advancing that or not? You see, for all eternity, you will say, I had the privilege, I was given the grace to be part of this great program of God, you see. And that is where, you see, imagine that you lived and you didn't contribute to the great dream of God, the dream of God that's in the heart of God for every human person. See, why we're alive is to contribute to God's dream, okay? And that's the great sadness. You see, Solomon, he began, and then he torpedoed it. Okay, other questions? Jenny.
I come from a
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Just coming back to that first, the division of powers. The division between church and state, you mentioned about Uzziah.
Yes.
And it says that he became powerful and his pride led to his downfall. He was unfaithful to the Lord. But what's the difference between what he did and what David did going into the temple and getting the loaves of bread?
Right. The question is, what is the difference between what Isaiah did? He goes into the temple and he acts as a priest, you remember, and God strikes him with leprosy. And David, okay, is trying to advance the purposes of the kingdom. And you remember, he goes to the priest, I think it was at Nob, and he asks for the showbread, okay, which was, of course, placed before the Lord, but normally eventually eaten by the priests. The whole thing is motive. The whole thing is motive. And you see, again, that's where love is the radicalization of law. And so what David does is not breaking the law. You see, had he gone in there to usurp the place of the priest, God would have struck him with leprosy as well. But it was rather the opposite. It was to advance and protect the priesthood. That's what his whole... That's why he was a man after God's own heart. And so it might seem at times, you know, that there's contradiction here, but there isn't. It's again like the Sabbath. Hey, the Sabbath was not made, okay? Sabbath was not made for man. Do you see what I mean? But man, or rather, the other way, I always mix it up. Man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for man, you see. But we can mix it up. But the whole thing revolves around motive. And if his motive was to usurp the priesthood for himself, God would have struck him with leprosy. Okay? Other questions? I want to take a moment, and kind of now we've kind of tumbled into the area of the law of God, I think there's just one thing I really want to say on that sheet that I think is that you look, are you looking at it there, Meryl? Yes. This is this email that was put online by this professor in Virginia. Now we're into the realm of the law of God in Chronicles, being replaced, Elijah and Elisha, Athaliah, etc., etc. Now, I'm not going to have time to deal with all of those in class, but I'd like to give you, we dealt with a couple of them, and Randy, could you grab that, any that are left on the table, and if you don't have them, and I regret that I've not been able to cover them all yet. We covered, let's see, 1 and 2. We covered 1 and 2. But I'd like to cover number 7. Because number 6. Because as I say, this sounds like, if you just went online, it kind of sounds like this is kind of cute, kind of funny, but the professor knows exactly what he's doing. And as I said before, that one way to enter into a debate is simply to reduce your opponent's arguments to absurdity. It's a classic means of debate. Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it's a classical... you know, means of rhetoric, arguments, that rather than simply logically going point to point, you don't do that. And you see, this is not necessarily a logical, you know, rational refuting of the law. It's much more subtle than that. It's simply making it absurd. It's making the law of God seem absurd. And so if you do that, of course, how can you use it? And so we dealt with 1 and 2, and I don't have time to deal with them all, but I'm going to go for as an example, because he could not be more wrong than he is. I would be embarrassed to have this posted online with my name under it, not because I'm a Christian, but because it is such a total misreading of God's word. And so I'm going to give you an example. I won't have time to deal with them all, but believe me, but what I will do with this one, you could do with all however many he lists there. You could do with all 10. With no overreaching whatever, with no overreaching whatever. So why don't we go there? And this is, let's look at question six. He says, a friend of mine feels that even though eating shellfish is an abomination, Leviticus 11:10, is it a lesser abomination than homosexuality, which is called an abomination in Leviticus 18:22? The same Hebrew word is used. I don't agree. Can you settle this? Are there degrees of abomination? And so you can clearly see what he's doing. What he's doing, I can find my notes here, and I get totally lost in my pieces of plastic, but this is the last class, so this is what I had for you on this sheet, so you'll be perhaps glad that we ran out of time. So, okay, you see, this is what he is doing with this little question number six. Okay, abomination, or detestable, depending on your translation, is used both for homosexuality and for certain kinds of food. And so they're really saying, just as we can now eat these foods without displeasing God, so we can practice homosexuality without displeasing God. Because the same word, abomination, is used for some seafood, or detestable, as is used for homosexuality. So let's turn then to Leviticus, let's turn to the text, Leviticus 11:10. And this has everything to do with Chronicles, okay? Because Chronicles is about defending the temple paradigm, and at the epicenter of the temple was the Holy of Holies, the epicenter of the epicenter was the Ark of God, the epicenter of the epicenter of the epicenter was the law of God, okay? This has everything to do with Chronicles, and this is one of the reasons why we have Chronicles. So if you turn back to Leviticus 11, now I can only use one example probably today, but believe me, we can do the same with every other thing he raises, every other thing on this list. And so Leviticus 11 verse 10, Leviticus 11:10, but whatever is in the seas and in the rivers that do not have fins and scales for quick identification among the teeming life of the water and among all the living creatures that are in the water, they are detestable to you. That's the word abomination, detestable. They might not be detestable to everybody, but they are detestable to you. Verse 11. And they shall be detestable, same word, to you. You may not eat of their flesh. The Moabites might be able to eat of their flesh, or the English might be able to eat of their flesh, but not you, okay? And and you may not eat of their flesh, and their carcasses you shall detest. Same word again, verse 12. Whatever is in the water that does not have fins and scales, easy identification, is an abomination to you. Okay, now look at my sheet quickly. In Leviticus 18, okay, homosexuality, the words are, it is detestable, homosexuality. It is. Okay, Leviticus 11:10, the words are, they are detestable to you. Not necessarily to everybody, not necessarily to the people in the New Covenant. Okay, you can eat your shrimp or whatever, or your lobster, but they'll be detestable to you. Okay, in this kind of, in this particular dispensation where God is working, I don't like to use that word very much, but you know what I mean, where God is trying to work something out, okay? It's detestable to you, not necessarily to all. Now, homosexuality, you see, is morally and intrinsically wrong. It is detestable. Eating certain foods is ceremonially and didactically, that simply means it's to teach us something, we'll come to that, wrong. You see the difference, and it's even it is detestable, okay? This is an absolute. It's detestable to you at this particular time, and we'll say why in just a minute. Now, this is borne out, if the professor had simply read on in his Bible, in this chapter, the word detest, we're talking about food, the word detestable and the word unclean are used as synonyms. So stay in Leviticus 11 and go down to verse 26. Been talking about all this and that food. Gets to verse 26. Concerning all the animals which divide the hoof, but do not make a split hoof for easy identification, or which chew the cud, this is Leviticus 11, verse 26, they are, what's the word? Unclean. Okay, so now he uses a synonym. He moves from the word detestable to the word unclean. Whatever, and whoever touches it becomes unclean, verse 27, and whatever walks on its paws. Okay, so Riley, we can't eat Riley. I'm sorry. He walks on his paws. We can't eat Riley. Okay, whatever walks on its paws among all the creatures for easy identification again, that is unclean to you. Notice verse 26. It's unclean to you. May not be for the Germans or whatever with their black sausage. You know what German black sausage is? It's just blood boiled down until it's hardens, and then they put it in sausage, black sausage. No, it's detestable to all of us. Okay, but it's detestable to you. Okay, this is something you aren't to do. Then if you go to verse 43, the two words are used in the same chapter. It goes through all the different foods again and whatever. Verse 43, do not render yourself detestable through any of the swarming things that swarm. You shall not make yourselves unclean so that you become unclean. And so what's happening is that these words, detestable and unclean, are used interchangeably in the passage. Homosexuality is never, ever, ever, ever described as uncleanness. Uncleanness is ceremonial, you see. These words, detestable and unclean, are simply used interchangeably with regards to food. And all that's happening here, you see, is that Israel's choice is restricted. There are many things, of course, about the food laws, and you know that. But just to pick up one, Israel's choice is restricted. As a reminder that God has restricted his choice to Israel. You see, every meal was a reminder that God had separated them out. Every piece of clothing you wore, couldn't mix fabrics, was a reminder that God had separated you out. When you sowed your field, okay, couldn't mix grains, reminder that God had separated you out. Not just for personal piety, but for a corporate commission. You see, the holiness being separated, yes, of course, it means that I need to be clean. But the reason, God wants everybody, okay, to be holy, but the reason for setting Israel aside, not eating these foods, whether you ate lobster or not, wasn't an issue of personal piety. It was a statement of a corporate commission that God had raised you up to create the womb into which the Messiah could be born and salvation could go to the ends of the earth and the wound of the world could be healed. And so every time you see you had a choice of what to eat, you remembered that you had to make a separation. Why? Because God has separated us, okay? What you spin on your loom. What you spin on your loom, okay, is another reminder that God has made a choice. He has set us aside. Okay, every time you go to your field, God has made a choice. He has set us aside. Why has he set us aside? So that we could be involved in healing the wound of the world, get his great program of salvation and redemption and justice to the ends of the earth. That was to be their reminder, you see. So they're unclean, and uncleanness, you see, is always didactic. It's to teach you something. After childbirth, a woman would be unclean. Okay, they didn't have to offer a sacrifice. There's no moral leprosy here. It's simply some maternity leave. She is excused from some religious obligations, some obligations to be intimate with her husband. Why? She is set aside for a period of rest and recovery. You see, it's not moral leprosy, uncleanness. is to teach us something. And today we need to remember that God has set us aside. Okay? Not so that you can just kind of be cleaned up and go to heaven. No, God has set us aside as a people, not just for personal piety, that's just the beginning, but for a corporate commission to do something in the earth, to be his people in the earth. And that's why we have, and we could say much more, and there were issues relating to hygiene for being a community initially in the desert and so forth. But that is just an illustration, and we could do that with every other item on this list. For instance, well, it's hardly worth... I really regret in some ways having... somebody asked me if I would deal with this. They found it. I kind of regret that I've not been able to deal with it all. But just believe me, we can... if the professor had read the whole chapter, he might have been embarrassed to publish the documents. And the same could be said for every other point. Where he sees injustice, God is speaking mercy. Where he sees brutality, God is setting up walls of protection. Every single point. Any questions? Got a few minutes here. Let's see if anybody else has one before we go to chat. Yeah, Dan?
God makes homosexuality forbidden. He also talks about all different kinds of incest. And I wonder if this guy is promoting child pornography, because that's where this is going to head
next.
Exactly.
How old
is the guy you can marry? Once you settle, guys can marry guys and girls can
marry
girls.
Well, and of course, that's already on the table. And you don't have to be a PhD in history to know these things. The once homosexuality becomes socially acceptable, we're not talking about marriage now. Once it becomes socially acceptable, the next stand, okay, is intergenerational homosexuality. And so again, there's nothing new under the sun. You go back to Socrates and Plato, and they're both offered teenage boys. And what would happen in Greek society is that married men, okay, would kind of take under their wing a teenage boy, and they would put that boy through the gymnasium, the equivalent of the university. They would be their patron, etc., etc., in exchange for sexual favors. They would be married, they would be having children, but they would be in a relationship, a sexual relationship, one generation down. Okay, that's where we go next. After that, you go to children, and excuse me for saying this in public, after that, you go to animals. Now, it's shocking to say these things in public, but that has happened in history. You can see this happening on Japanese television, I kid you not. And you see, we are cocooned. We're cocooned, you see, in a Judeo-Christian tradition. And that's why it makes me angry when people cut off the branch that we're sitting on. They don't realize that God has redeemed us from a horrible quagmire, moral quagmire. And now we get people who are wanting to disinherit. Now, where have movements for the abolition of slavery come from? Okay, where has the hospice movement come from? Where did the civil rights movement come from? Where did the stand against apartheid come from? Okay, where did the Jubilee Project come from? You could go on and on and on and on. The whole history of the West is taking biblical truth and applying it against injustice, against exploitation, against moral perversion, you see. And that's why to say that we move from men to boys, from boys to children, and of course you all know the horrible stories of businessmen going to the Philippines, and that's where this goes. That's where this goes. And you see, perversion, you see, perversion just becomes normal, and so you need another level, you see. And that's why then it goes into things that are so horrible, we don't even want to talk about them in public. But they have been They have been in the history of society. And so you just want to say, you see, and the worry, you see, is so difficult to frame the argument other than simply said, the best thing to say is simply that God says it's wrong and therefore it is wrong. We don't have to really say any more, you know, but hey, we do want to sometimes say, we are soaring off the branch we are sitting on. And you see, and we have been so protected, all the freedoms we enjoy today, even for me to be able to speak like this. Okay, you could not do this in most societies in history. I would not have the freedom to speak like this. But you see, it's like health. You don't appreciate health until you lose it. Okay, and some of us, we have our good friend called Ardian. Some of you know Ardian, this sweet man who got his citizenship last Monday after Ardian's wonderful story that his father stood against the regime, the atheist regime. His father was an extremely educated man, educated in Paris and Germany, multilingual. They were exiled to the border up in the mountains. Ardian could not go to university because of his father's stand against the authorities, eventually escaped from Albania, eventually got to America, long, long story, eventually ended up in Omaha, eventually Jenny and somebody else rang his doorbell, and they were Christmas caroling, and right downtown, and he brought them in, and he had almost nothing in his flat except a few little books on a bookshelf. He said, I need to show you something. And it was an English Bible. And he said, I found this in a library in Albania. The only reason it was in the library is they didn't know what it was, because it was in English. And Ardian comes here every Sunday. But Ardian, you see, he knows the faults of America. We know the faults of America. I know the faults of Britain. But hey, we have freedoms that people would die for. We would die for. And so when the European Union says, we just want a freedom, virtue, access, okay, nonsense. You can't have it, you see. So these things are guarding everything that is precious. They're guarding our children, they're guarding the poor, they're guarding justice, they're guarding morality, and we will not let them be swept away. Without one hell of a fight, okay? Without one hell of a fight. So, and that is Chronicles. That's Chronicles. So it's a good place to end, and I promise you I'd never go after 1 o'clock, but we are 4 minutes after one. I apologize, and have a great summer. We'll see each other as we're in church, and then we'll resume after the break. So yeah, I've got it. It's excellent.
That's wonderful.